Get in on all the sports action and your chance to win up to 100 times your cash with Prize Picks, America's number one fantasy sports app. Download the app today. Use code MIB for a first deposit match up to $100. This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League Two after 15 long seasons of exile in the National League. Dedicated staff and passionate supporters celebrate the city's return to glory, the big time, all while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in that higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One's promised land? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu. You're listening to the Men in Blazers Media Network. Suboptimal Radio.
Welcome to a Men in Blazers pod special. It's Dave O here with a new installment of our pod special series presented by our friends at Camarena Tequila, who are supporting this collection of extended conversations with some of the biggest guests in the Men in Blazers universe. Our guest today is only the second ever American-born manager to take charge of a Premier League club. That is right, Wisconsin's own Jesse Marsh. As you're about to hear, Rog and Jesse trace the Princeton alum's journey from Midwest rec soccer through MLS and into the crucible of European management and the lessons that Jesse has learned from his journey. So here it is, our Men in Blazers pod special with Jesse Marsh, presented by Camarena Tequila.
My guest today is a trailblazing American, the pride of Racine, Wisconsin, a gent who became only the second American-born human being in our nation's history to take the reins of the Premier League club when he became manager of mighty Leeds United. And I admire him so much. He's a risk-taker, a pioneer, a gent who truly believes in the power of the collective. And a lot rests on his success at Leeds from an American perspective. And he said recently, he thrives under that kind of pressure. In his words, I like being the underdog. I like having to fight for things. I like having my back against the wall. It's a joy to welcome Mr. Jesse Marsh.
Roger, how we doing, buddy? I don't know about that intro. That's more pressure than anything, the things you're advertising me as.
Well, we will walk through this step by step because I do believe I've only spoken the truth. And Jesse, I want to go right back to the beginning of your journey. You grew up in non-traditional football, soccer, territory, Racine, Wisconsin, the Badger State. And age seven, you started playing in a rec league. Can you just give us a blast of the state of Wisconsin youth football back in the 1980s so we get a sense of the turf from which you emerged?
We played ice hockey, we played basketball, we played these kinds of things. And then, of course, we were all Green Bay Packer fans. I'd been to a Chicago Sting game. I had been to a Milwaukee Wave indoor soccer game. But most of all these things were new to my family, my brother and I, so it was certainly not a big sport. It was all rec, YMCA soccer. I just played with a bunch of my buddies from home. I happened to be good at it. And then we created what we call the travel team or the select team when I was about 8 or 9 years old. And that was the first time that I really started thinking about what the sport would look like.
Age 12. Your life changed. You persuaded somehow your parents to send you to Europe for a month to barnstorm with a United States select soccer team. And that experience, you've said, opened your eyes to the depth of the passion and cultures of the game across Europe. Would you say that was where your life path was first imagined, that sense of wanderlust and the realization that there was a bigger football world out there?
It was less about football and more just about European experience and cultural experience. And so I started seeing other languages. One day we'd be in Paris and then we'd drive to Munich and we'd see how things would operate. This was before the wall came down. So we actually went into Berlin and we drove through East Germany, went through the borders. And that really opened my eyes to what was out there. And certainly from being from Racine, Wisconsin, where not that many people really leave, I think it really sparked my imagination for what I wanted my life to become.
You went on to play college soccer at Princeton with the intent of learning under then Tigers coach Bob Bradley. And Bob, became your manager after that for six seasons in MLS. There are only two American-born men who've coached in the Premier League, and I'm fascinated by this early formative connection between the two of you. What is it about this branch of the American coaching tree that has allowed you two to emerge? Is it Ivy League confidence? Is it the beers at the Tiger's Tail? Something tactical? Why you and Bob, Jesse? How do you understand it?
I would first say that Bob was the first person to introduce high-level football to me. When we were at university at Princeton, he was talking about zonal marking, and he was talking about tactics, and he was teaching us how to play the game at a different level than anything I'd ever seen. It made me a better player, and it also, I think, provided me the opportunity to become a professional. Why are we the two? I don't know. I don't know.
The American Club League, MLS, was launched the winter of your senior year of college, and you forwent job offers in finance and advertising to go pro at a time when the minimum salary was $24,000, and you began to embark on a successful 13-year career in the league. Jesse, how would you describe your footballing style for those who didn't get to see you play?
It was poor. I was too slow, too technically deficient, but I was intelligent. I was competitive, and I tried to be a leader, and I tried to think through the game. As a defensive midfielder, I tried to really maximize the potential of all the players around me and see if I could galvanize a group tactically, mentally, in every way to be successful. I learned from a lot of really good players. I was on a lot of really good teams. I had a lot of success in the league, but it was all generated by the group. At like 25, 26, I took my badges. I knew I wanted to be a coach. And so I treated a lot of my playing career like a research project as to what it would be like when I became a manager.
I remember you as quite a pest, unafraid to welcome David Beckham to the league by giving him a good swift kick to the groin.
You know what? That was not a smart foul by Jesse Marsh. And did you see the reaction of David Beckham? Beckham and Jesse Marsh, the 33-year-old veteran. Those two are going to fight.
Yeah, I would describe myself as not highly liked by opponents. But to be honest, I didn't want to be liked by the opponents. I didn't care. I wanted to win. I wanted to be better than they were. I wasn't in it to make friends. I was in it to succeed. I was in it to be successful and win. And sometimes it meant that I crossed the line a little bit. But I'd say I'm a little different as a manager. As a player, I was very much focused on winning and doing whatever it took every day on the pitch to win. And as a manager, I know that winning is important, but I'm much more committed to the process and development and the idea of a group.
When you retired in 2009, you went straight into coaching, working for 2 years as an assistant to your old friend, Bob Bradley, who was by then coaching the US men's national team. A year in MLS followed as head coach at Montreal Impact. And then you famously took 3 years off, a period which included 6 months with your wife and three kids on a backpacking trip around the globe. And I don't want to get too off topic here, but it is amazing. Again, an instance of you, Jesse Marsh, willing to think differently. And I'm fascinated. What's the greatest lesson about life you took from this unique moment in time?
I learned that no one cared about my record as a coach in MLS. In India, when you're on the streets of India, or when you're in Asia, or when you're in some of these tougher areas of the world, that football doesn't matter very much. And it's more about being in a community, how you treat people, not having a big ego, about learning about cultures and religions and people and the way people exist and coexist.
There weren't too many Montreal Impact fans on the beach at Goa.
There was, I wasn't on the beaches in Goa, by the way. I was in Varanasi on the Ganges in the toughest of areas. We backpacked. We were in hostels. We weren't in Marriott's. We tried to really experience the life of people in these cultures. That trip was really important for my family and I, and at the time we spent together. And people would say to me a lot, wow, your kids must have learned a lot. And I said, yeah, I actually think my wife and I learned more. And I swore that when I got back into football again, that I was going to use that perspective to benefit me more.
You returned eventually, establishing yourself as a New York Red Bull legend over the course of 4 seasons, becoming the winningest coach in club history. And now, Jesse, there's a sliding doors version of this story where you stay in the United States, become an MLS legend, and maybe eventually a tap for the US men's national team job. But instead, in the middle of the 2018 season, you do something not enough American coaches have had the confidence to do. You announce you're leaving to work as an assistant at RB Leipzig under Ralf Rangnick. And this was a shock move at the time, trading in the head leadership role for that of a backup. What did you sense that you needed to learn by moving to Europe that you could never learn in the United States?
Yeah, I don't know if that's exactly the way I would describe it, that there wasn't something I could learn, but I felt like I was in a comfort zone for sure. And I was still learning in New York, but not at the rate that I felt like I needed to really get better. So there was a lot of things about going to Leipzig. First of all, whether I'm an assistant or a head coach, I treat the role the same. It's about helping the team be successful and doing whatever you can to prepare and run training every day and have relationships with the young men so that they can grow and get better. So the role didn't really matter to me as much, but I knew that learning another language, being ingrained in European football, we were in Europa League that year, the idea to get to Champions League, that the level of everything about the sport, the attention, the media, the players, the talent, the tactics, that at every level, things were higher and it was going to test me at a major level. And I tell you, the major reason I did it wasn't about success. It was about that I had a philosophy of the way that I think about leadership. And I wanted to see if it could function in the most competitive world of our sport, which is being here in Europe. So I'm about people, I'm about development, I'm about relationships, and I'm about challenging people to be the best versions of themselves. And if I want to be about that, then don't I have to personally live that every day? That's what I try to do. I try to get to the core of who I can be as the best version of myself and how I can get there and what are the steps I need to take.
Into your move to Red Bull Salzburg in the Austrian Bundesliga, where you're announced as head coach in June 2019. You and your wife and your three kids made a pact to approach life with a spirit that when you felt intimidated by the newness, you wouldn't shy away from it. You'd actually embrace it, to try and accept it, to try and understand it. And I love this quote of yours, "I've gotten more comfortable with being uncomfortable."
Yeah.
What was the most uncomfortable thing in a football context that you encountered, and how did you learn to adapt?
The biggest stress or anxiety I had was when I was first going to Salzburg and I knew that I was going to be coaching entirely in German. And would the team and the players accept me and understand me as well in another language as they would in my native tongue? Now, I wasn't sure when I first went there what that would be like. What I found actually is the vulnerability that I showed by not being perfect in the language actually brought them closer to me, and they were helping me. Like how I try to create a team that's a project and where everybody feels like they have a voice and they're valued within the system that we create, I found that they were also doing the same for me with my German and committing themselves and investing in their relationship with me and helping me get better at communicating. So it was a really positive group of young men, a really positive environment, an incredible club, and it was perfect for me at the time.
But we have to note, when you were unveiled, the fans there didn't throw you, should we say, the warmest reception, hanging a banner, "Nein zu Marsch, no to Marsch," in the stands. Honestly, Jesse, what's it feel like to be greeted at a big job, in a big moment for you, with banners like that?
It motivates me. I like that. Maybe I'm not totally psychologically fit for this, but it was the same when I went to the New York Red Bulls. They had a town hall and they screamed at Ali Curtis and I.
Hang on a second.
Yes, you fire best coach. What the hell's wrong?
Hang on a second.
2 years of success and you fire
these guys, you're going to get a chance.
Honestly, if that makes you afraid, then you're in the wrong business, because you have to show the fans, you have to prove to them that you're the right guy by the way the team plays and by the passion the team shows for each other. And so it's not my job as coach to be loved by the fans. My job as coach is that the team is loved by the fans and that the team represents what the fan base is. That's what I think is most important.
Spoiler alert, you proceeded to win hearts and minds in Salzburg, transforming the team into serial winners, leading them back into the Champions League for the first time in 11 years. Jesse, to have experienced the banners, does it feel doubly remarkable to deliver those achievements and take those who once doubted you to the Champions League promised land?
I heard comments that every coach wins at Salzburg, and they're right. It's an incredible club with a great infrastructure. But what I think I brought more than anything, other than committing to the playing philosophy in a very aggressive way, was also the notion that we have to be a Champions League club, that we can't look back, and that our ambition has to be that has to be always our goal, that every year we're in Champions League. And before I came, there was major anxiety about overcoming that hurdle, about can we get into Champions League? What would that look like? And so that's a little bit the Americanness in me, I think. The ambition to be at the highest level and commit to great levels of success, to say it out loud. Austrians are good people, they're humble people, and they don't want to overextend their boundaries in terms of talking about being ambitious because it's considered arrogant. We Americans, we're very good at being arrogant. I believe it's confidence. It's not arrogance, it's confidence, right? But that piece of the puzzle was really important for Salzburg. Really, it was. And I think it will continue to be part of the club moving forward.
You became the first American to coach in and win a match in the Champions League. A reminder that we have to talk about that locker room team talk you gave when playing Liverpool in the Champions League group stage in 2019.
Since the Champions League spielen, wir müssen Cooper League auf dem Platz and get stuck in mit Druck, diese Aktion, manchmal mit Van Dijk, ja?
And I know it embarrasses you that it went so viral, but it is such a remarkable piece of video, one that put a huge dent in the stigma against American coaches. Jesse, watching you scream at your players in a mix of German,
nicht mit einem richtig gut tackle or ein fight,
English,
they have to feel us, guys,
and the universal language of swear word,
we're f***ing here to compete.
Was that a performance calculated to fire your team up, or was it pure, genuine, spur of the minute emotion?
The key for any halftime is to find your finger on the pulse of exactly what's necessary for your team at that moment. It can't be that I'm yelling at them every time, because they'll go deaf to that. But certainly understanding what's the right tactical message, what's the right motivational message, what is the game going to look like, using experiences to help the team understand how to handle the moment is really important. And I like those moments. So yeah, you're right. I didn't like that it went out so quickly, because normally I had to see it before it went out and they released it without me seeing it. It was okay. In America, we love our sports documentaries, right? Because it's a insight to reality of what those lifestyles are and the passion of what sports is. And so I live that. That's my experience. That's who I am. My office is a sold-out stadium. That's my office, and that's where I'm comfortable. But for people, I think, to see what goes into that and what it means, the buildup to those moments, the preparation, the use of experiences, I think people are inspired by that, and I'm glad that people enjoyed that. But those things are real. They're not manufactured. They're not a show. They're real.
My favorite line is actually one of the more PG-13 ones.
We're going to talk a little bit about tactics, but we got to step on that field. It's us against them.
And your team, man, they 2-goal comeback at the beginning of the second half of that match before ultimately falling to a Mo Salah winner. And you've said that you see the game as 25% tactical and 75% mental. Tactics, whether they work or don't work, they're easy to implement. But what's the secret to changing a team's mentality?
They fit together. My playing model is very aggressive, and I believe it feeds the kind of mentality and the kind of person I am. Understanding in the moment what is tactically happening on the pitch, and then how to be clear about how to make adjustments at all times with subs, with formations, with halftimes, all of that. But then matching the mindset of what a certain moment is and bringing those things together to create a clear idea for what the next moment needs to look like in your season, in a game, whatever it may be, is certainly a very, very important skill as a coach. And it's one that I enjoy, right? It's one that I love. This is who I am. This is what my experiences are as a player, as a coach, as all of it. And I've been lucky to be part of a lot of really good teams and around a lot of good environments and good coaches and good players, and to be able to use those experiences to benefit me in the situation I'm in now.
You returned to Leipzig at the start of this season to take over from Julian Nagelsmann after he leapt to Bayern Munich. And there's obviously many factors that go into whether a team works under a certain manager at a certain time. But I think it's safe to say, for whatever reason, the Marsch method didn't work at Leipzig. You and the club agreed to a conscious uncoupling at the end of December. And Jesse, you're a bloke who puts an incredible amount of energy into thinking about winning mentalities. This, really, your first taste of failure in almost a decade. And American coaches have such a short leash in European football. One failure can signal the executioner. For even a moment, did it ever cross your mind that that might be your last European job?
Yeah, of course. Of course. But I didn't care. It was a brave decision to leave Leipzig. It was a brave decision. But I knew I didn't belong. I knew it wasn't right for me. I knew that the player pool and I didn't fit together. I knew that the playing style had changed. I knew that the club had changed. And even when I was there the first time as an assistant, I'd be honest with you, I didn't think it vibed with me perfectly. And it's okay. It's okay for me to admit that. And it's okay for Leipzig also to move on and be positive and have success. And that's what I want because I love that club. I loved my experience with Red Bull. And that's what I care about the most. So even if I knew I'd never got a job again, I knew that that was the right decision for me. I am very proud of that decision.
Take us back to the first moment you heard about the possibility of Leeds United. Where were you? How did you hear? What was your initial immediate reaction?
I followed English football and I knew about Leeds United and even some of the glory years back in the 60s. And this is a historic club. I played against Leeds United when I was at DC my first year. We had a friendly match.
That was your first career start. 89th minute, Tony Sanegal rescued a 1-1 draw for Busi Arena.
When they first reached out to me, Victor Orta,
Leeds United's director of football,
in the first pandemic lockdown, he reached out to me and said, I would like to have a Zoom call with you and talk a little bit about our club. He said, we have a great coach. His name's Marcelo Bielsa. I knew Marcelo, obviously, from all the different places he had been and the type of football he plays. I'd followed Leeds because they were looking like they were going to emerge as the promotion team to come into the Premier League the next year. But what was really interesting is Victor showed me statistics about the way they played. He talked about some of their run performances, and then he compared them with the way that my teams played in both Salzburg and New York. And he talked about how there were similarities. Frankly, he said, listen, we do a really good job of trying to scout players that we think will fit into our system. And we also do a good job of trying to create a network of coaches that we think can also be possibility year after year. And he goes, it's not because we want to get rid of our coach. It's because we always want to have a plan in place. That kind of preparation, that kind of mindset, that kind of statistical analysis, that hits home with me because that's how I think and that's how I operate. And even when I've thought about going from club to club, even though I've stayed a lot in the Red Bull business, I've looked at statistical data and what different places would look like for me and what the player pool is. So I thought it was really smart to have a sport director like that. And right away, I was drawn to the idea of Leeds United, not about being in the Premier League or anything like that, but just being attached to something where I thought there was a similar mindset.
As that possibility became real, you were not just going to replace another manager. You were going to be the successor, really, of a demigod. Bielsa, the man, the legend, the bucket. Did any part of you feel a sense of fear? A sense of, yes, I want to coach in the Premier League, but it's very hard to be the man who replaces the man.
No, I think it was more I had respect for Marcelo and what he had accomplished here. And it's normal that at some point a coach has to move on. I did like the fact that his team and his players played with energy and with passion, were aggressive. And I could also see that that would fit in many ways with the way that I like to think about the game. So coming to Leeds United and following Marcelo Bielsa, who's a club legend, if I was afraid of those things, I wouldn't have made this decision. But those things don't faze me as much as making sure that on the inside we have something that we think has major potential and can move in the direction that I think it needs to go.
Now, Jesse, as I said, you are the second American-born bloke to manage a Premier League team. You know this. In 2016, Bob Bradley was sacked by Swansea after 85 days. What did you learn from watching your friend, Bob Bradley, take that risk and fail so excruciatingly? Did you speak to him before taking the job? Did you get his insight?
I didn't speak to him, but we had spoken many times before about his experience in Swansea. He's obviously disappointed by it, and it was very unfair in many ways. And I say that maybe if a couple results went in a little bit different way, that maybe the outcome would have been different. He knew he was getting into a difficult situation, and much like I know I was getting into a difficult situation, I certainly was inspired by his career and his coming here. And I was also incredibly disappointed by the way things went for him at Swansea and the way he was treated. But I learned a lot from being around Bob, from playing for him, and then watching him in Europe. I think I learned a lot from him.
You arrived in Leeds, which is such a magnificent, singular, proud, stiff-necked city. Yorkshire, such a unique state of mind. You've actually said Milwaukee, Wisconsin reminds you of it. Factory town, built on hard-working families. But there was no time for a honeymoon.
Even when I showed up at customs when I first got to Leeds and came into the airport, one of the passport officials says to me, "So you're here to save us?" And I said, "No, I'm here for us to save us. This is not my job to be the savior. My job is to be a piece of the puzzle within Leeds United to help us achieve the goals and the potential that we think we can."
I have been blown away by your press conferences, your humor, your lack of defensiveness.
Do you feel there's a stigma around American coaches in English football?
Yeah, I think there's probably a stigma. I'm not sure Ted Lasso helped. I haven't watched the show, but I get it. Like, people hate hearing the word soccer. They hate hearing, you know, I mean, I've used the word football since I was a professional football player. I think more and more in the States, we're adapting to what the game here is in England and our connection with what this league is and what the culture of the sport is in this country. I can understand that they don't think that we have the experiences that can be created here in Europe. Frankly, they're right, right? I mean, it was the reason I came to Europe. It was the reason I learned German. It was the reason I tried to adapt to new cultures. This is the fifth country I've coached football in. So, and it takes me out of my comfort zone every time. It challenges me to grow and develop and learn new things. I'm very open to that. I'm very cognizant of the fact that I'm not perfect and I don't want to be. And all I can say is the only way I know how to do things is to go all in, to give everything I have, to believe in who I am, to believe in the people that I work with, and to try to maximize what we are every day. And I find if you can do that effectively, that you can be incredibly surprised with the human spirit and what you can achieve. So that sounds like Ted Lasso, I think, from what I've heard.
What I've learned from it is how to modify certain terminology, but also I think I learned that I have to just be myself. If people don't like certain things I say, and if people want to make fun of me, I can laugh at that. The Ted Lasso thing, I think, even brings more humor to the entire situation, which I'm okay with. My wife keeps hoping that maybe someday I'll get the chance to be on Ted Lasso, even though neither one of us have seen the show. And then we can maybe make fun of each other on the show. Okay? So it's okay. I try to say penalty. I try to say football. I try to say the things that aren't lightning rods for people to attack me as much, which then in turn, I hope, allows me to work in a very quiet way with the team so that we can get the things done that we need to get done to be successful.
What did it feel like stepping out for that first game at Leicester City? Was it just another match or did it feel different? Were you nervous at all?
No, I wasn't nervous. I was focused on the team. I was focused on, could we get the kind of performance together after 4 days that could give us the chance to understand how I wanted us to play moving forward? And could we release some of the stress and anxiety that the team had from being in this relegation fight? I knew that staying calm was going to be the most important thing. So at about the 55th, 60th minute, when we were playing fantastic, I was really excited to see the players adapt and play the way they did. And right then I knew, okay, we have a real shot at this.
I mean, you talk about that first game, your Leeds dominated for spells, but couldn't take their chances. It ended a 1-0 loss with a lot of positives, after which you beckoned your substitutes off the bench to join the rest of the players on the field, and you huddled at the centre circle. And I watched that, Jesse, and saw a manager attempting to establish the collective spirit that is the core of his philosophy, a little bit like Jurgen Klopp. In his first season at Liverpool, he made his team join hands and celebrate a 2-2 draw against West Brom, for which he was mocked at the time. Were you aware as you did this that your midfield moment would be remembered as one of wonder if you eventually turn things round, or be pilloried if not?
I didn't care. In those moments, I'm not doing anything for the media or for the greater football fans here in England. All I care about is the team. I wanted to make sure at that moment that the team understood how they had just performed was fantastic. And that I had never seen a group after 1 week of being together execute a new plan, a my version of football plan, the way that they had. And I wanted to make sure that they walked off the pitch positive, strong, united, and believing in what we were doing. And so I thought it was funny afterwards when it became a little bit of a talking point or some people wanted to criticize. I've done that many times and I never do it for anyone other than us.
Win or lose, your team have been audacious. The 94th minute, Joe Gelhart moment of wonder against Norwich. The Wolves game. At one point, commentator Peter Drury screamed poetically about you at halftime. He looked as if he was drowning. Now he looks like he's walking on water. Jesse, how do you experience that roller coaster? Do you just embrace the chaos? Are you trying to control it?
They've been two sensational results. In the match, they kind of played out a little bit differently. At home, we were really strong against Norwich in the first half. Really strong. Could have been up 3-4, 5-0. And then the game, if it stays 1-0 and you're not able to capitalize, it always gets a little bit tricky at the end. The way we responded at that moment from the minute the whistle blew for at 1-1 for the kickoff was really strong. And that said a lot about the mentality of the group. And then I think at the Wolves match, with all the injuries, with giving up a goal in the last second of that half, how strange that game was, we reorganized ourselves at halftime to put together a second half performance that we can hang our hat on in a big way.
Ailing! This is transformational! This is sensational! This is Leeds from the dead!
These are the moments that I love, and they don't always go according to script, but the goal is to make sure that at least we're mentally and physically able to put ourselves in situations to create those moments. And it's a big credit to the young men we have here and to the quality and mentality we have within this team. And I'm just trying to access those qualities every day and maximize the potential of who these guys are. So pretty fantastic, no doubt. And we will use it to continue to galvanize us and push us forward. That's for sure.
Do you feel that you're not just fighting for your career, but you're also battling as a pathfinder for all the American coaches on the men's side who wish to follow you? Or do you think only about yourself?
No, I don't do either of those things. I think only about the team. This is all that matters to me. I don't have the time or energy to even think about those things because I have to focus entirely on making sure that I represent my role within this club to the best of my abilities. If I can do that to help this group, then I know that with the people, the leadership we have in the club, with the player pool that we have, with the potential of this fan base and the potential of this club, that we can be massively successful. And then in turn, that's the best thing I can do for this image of what's important for American soccer.
Jesse Marsh, Godspeed. It can't be long before you go full Friedel and start to talk in an English accent. To you, to your family, to Leeds, mighty Leeds, America's rooting for you. Courage.
Thanks, Roger.
There is also a television version of that interview in which Rog and Jesse relive that incredible Red Bull Salzburg halftime talk at Liverpool frame by frame. It is available this Sunday, April 3rd on Peacock. And again, a special shout out to Camarena, who are making these extended pods with the likes of Arsene Wenger, RZA and Will Ferrell possible. We should also mention that Camarena is the official tequila of La Liga. Until next time, this is Mikey Three Limes reminding you that Camarena tequila is 40% alcohol by volume. Please enjoy responsibly and always remember, stay in charge.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Men in Blazers ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know, after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used. Because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.